that was the pivotal moment where I realized I need to prioritize myself and my well-being over work. And once I figured that out, that stuck with me forever, up until now. I'll never let work compromise how, you know, my daily life is going, my self-care, how I feel about myself.
All right, Trish, welcome to Money Bites.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. The first question is a one-liner of yourself. How would you introduce yourself?
I would say I'm Trish. I am a super nerd. I am, you know, product manager. I love technology, but I am also the most fun, bubbly, and charismatic person you'll ever meet. And I would also say that I just love the people around me. I love bringing positive energy to people's lives. And I really identify with being able to share like positive experiences and energy with the people around me.
I love that. Fun, bubbly, and charismatic. That is
how I would describe myself.
Love it. Love it. And maybe adjacent to that, what might be a fun fact or a trivia that people don't know about you?
Ooh, okay. This is a good one. I have an identical twin sister, actually, and we look totally alike, the same, except that she doesn't dye her hair like I do. So she has black hair and she has a nose piercing. But aside from those things, we look very similar and it always throws people off.
I wonder if she's going to make an appearance into your story as we go through it.
I'm sure she will.
Yeah. Love it. Love it. Well, your first foray into your career didn't start out as a PM. You started out as a business analyst, and you also didn't start in tech. You started in finance.
Right.
How did you get in? What did you like about it?
Yeah. So I ended up in finance because, you know, I studied engineering at Cornell, but I was in operations research engineering. So it's kind of this interesting major where you're doing some computer science related things, but you're also kind of doing like learning about supply chain, like it's industrial engineering, like these type of things. So for me, as I was looking at jobs and I was thinking about going into the real world, as they call it, I was like, I don't really know like where a good application of my skills would lie. And so the reason I ended up in finance is because a lot of my peers around me were applying for and getting those jobs, right? So I had friends going to Goldman and Morgan Stanley and, you know, all of these companies, and they were like, oh, I want to go into banking, or I want to go into the tech side of finance. So I just thought, okay, maybe this is what I should do, right? So as a result of that, I ended up interning and then later on working at Credit Suisse. I was a business analyst there and a project manager, but I was on the tech side of the company. So things like trading algorithms, regulatory reporting, like technology, I was kind of focused on building those out from a technology standpoint. So what I liked about that was I could definitely see the impact of my work. I saw why it mattered. And I saw like the technology piece of it kind of started to click in my brain, like, oh, this is what actually interests me, not the finance piece. So I would say that's kind of what helped me realize that I wanted to go into tech. And then what I didn't like about it was, no, I'm not going to lie, like, I just kind of thought finance was boring. It wasn't for me. I didn't care about it. Like, I had friends who were like, oh, I love this stuff. Like, I love banking. I care so deeply about this. And for me, it sparked no joy whatsoever. I was like, I am bored by this.
Super interesting. So were you actually coding internal tools?
Yes. That's gotcha. Exactly what I was doing.
And then you switched over to project management. One question that we get often is, what's the difference between a project manager versus a product manager?
Oh, that's such a good question. I love talking about this. I was actually on a panel recently and I got the same question. So the way that I like to think about it is like product management is more like the why, like of what we're building. And you also are very close on like the what of what we're building, right? So when you're the product manager, you're not just responsible for ensuring that the project gets done or the product gets built. You're responsible for figuring out what are the customer problems that you're trying to solve, right? What are the issues? Like, what are kind of things, who are the customers, right? You're asking and you're answering all of those questions. And once you get to that, then you're working with Eng and, you know, your design team, your UXR team on, okay, how do we solve these problems for these customers? What do we build? And you oversee everything from the ideation phase, right, to the building phase, to launch, to post-launch, to metrics. You're responsible for all of that. Where project management is more so like you're kind of the person that is responsible for like timelines, milestones, ensuring the actual work gets done, right? But you're not necessarily involved in those decisions of what are we building? Why are we building it? who are the customers? You're not really doing that. You're more so like the person that's helping all of the teams corral against the goal and getting them there. So that's kind of why, like, to speak to why I made the transition from project to product. Like, for me, as I was doing project management, and I saw things that were happening that maybe I didn't necessarily agree with, right? Like, oh, we're going to prioritize this. And then I would be responsible for executing. But I'd be like, oh, but why? And I started asking those questions like, oh, are you sure we don't want to do this thing instead? Or is that really the best way to solve this problem? And then I realized, it clicked for me, like, oh, like maybe I would really want to go into product because these are the type of questions that I'm trying to answer, right? Not just being the execution person.
Love it. So it sounds like it's a difference between the what and how versus why.
Yes.
I also find your life satisfaction graph super interesting because I've never seen someone who is as step advancing as you are. But while you were at Credit and Droid, you had a really high life satisfaction level in terms of being in a new city and all of that. Yeah. But your sort of money/net worth and career satisfaction was starting from a lower place.
Yes.
Where was that discrepancy coming from?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I think for me, because like I kind of looked to be more satisfied in the life side of things because of the fact that I wasn't necessarily enjoying my career, the work I was doing, not really getting the pay that I wanted. So instead of kind of like putting my heads down on my career and being like, oh, I really want to, you know, fix my career satisfaction, I was like, okay, I'm just going to take this as it is. And then I'm going to take that time outside of work and start doing a lot of hobbies and things that I enjoy. So like with the time that I had outside of work, I kind of, you know, I started singing in a band. Like I did a lot of fun stuff with friends, a lot of trips, like things like that. And so I kind of was like, okay, like the work stuff will figure itself out, but I'm not going to let it bring me down, right? Where now I feel like I'm at a place where I have satisfaction with both of those things in my life and like a very high work satisfaction. But it's interesting because like, I feel like a lot of people would have a low life satisfaction if their work satisfaction was low, but I wasn't going to let that like bring me down per se.
I definitely want to go further into this because I think that balance is something that I've been struggling with personally.
Yeah.
But until we get to that point in mm-hmm. your current role where you've, you know, gotten the best of both worlds, your next jump into CoinDesk, you mm-hmm. had a huge jump in terms of career satisfaction. What was yes. the difference then?
So that was my first consumer product role. So that was the first time that I was building products that users were actually like using. And by users, I mean like everyday people like you and I, and not like the previous product I worked on was a business to business. So I think that was one for me, is just seeing the impact of my work and like it really mattered and not really in that like bubble of finance, but seeing people like go onto CoinDesk, read the articles, like, you know, use the information to understand how they should invest in crypto. Like I was like, this is cool. Like I'm actually making a difference like in these people's lives. So that was one.
For Droid as well, that when you were a product manager for a B2B, is it yeah. harder for you to see impact on your clients?
Yes, because the thing was the clients were banks. And for me, like a lot of times, like if you did something well, you executed a new product, like there wasn't necessarily that sense of like seeing your impact or gratitude or anything like that. It was just more so like, this is how it is. This is what you're supposed to do. And you know, you do it, you launch to the product, the consumers that are the banks, they're like, okay, great. We're going to run our trades through it. And then you just move on to the next thing. So that actually gave me a really low satisfaction because I felt like I wasn't seeing the impact of what I was doing and the big picture, right? Like I didn't really know what the big picture was of what we were doing. Like, yeah, we're helping, you know, companies report their trades and be regulatorily compliant, but what does that mean? Why is that like important in the grand scheme of things? Like mm-hmm. I get it now, I get why it is, right? But I think it was when I was young like that, it was tolling on me to not really see that big picture.
Interesting. Okay, so you moved to a more consumer facing role, you're yeah. seeing the impact,
yes,
and you're much more satisfied, but you weren't fully satisfied here either.
Nope. I'm a tough girl. I'm a tough girl.
love it. What was missing here?
So yeah, that's an amazing question. I think like, so what I loved about it, so it was a news media website for crypto. So what I loved about it was being able to be creative. Like I actually got to launch an entire redesign of the website when I was there, which was like so amazing for me because it was essentially being like, we don't like, you know, we don't like the current way that it's looking. It looks kind of like a little bit distrustful, hackery. We want to make ourselves look like a credible, you know, news source. We want to redo the entire website and like, go, you're like tasked with this. And it was to me, and I reported to the chief product officer, and it was really hands-on and cool. So I loved that. However, you know, when you're an editorial website, right? Who's the person that's really making the product decisions at the end of the day? Is it the product managers, or is it the editorial team, who is extremely valued by the company because they're the ones writing the articles and they're the ones who are really educated on crypto, right? Who are the ones that are really making the decision at the end of the day? So what I found there was that while when I interviewed, they claimed that product managers were going to be empowered to make the decisions, that was not the truth of it. It was like, oh, you could do this as a product manager, but if editorial wants you to do it a different way, then you actually can't do that. And so for me, it was like tough because I saw a lot of my ideas and things that I knew were good for the users, right? Like kind of being shut down because it just wasn't what those teams wanted. And so that, like, I would say my career satisfaction was higher than the other companies because I was seeing the impact of my work and working with consumers, but I didn't really feel like that autonomy and empowered really in the role, which is why I took a next step after that to leave.
You think, having experienced that, any questions that you asked during the interview process to your potential employer that might raise flags of how much ownership you might have?
Yes. So I'll always ask a few different questions around this when I'm doing a job interview. I asked this for Meta, like I asked this for Grubhub, which was the next role after CoinDesk that I took. But I would say one, like, ask what is the organizational like structure like in terms of making decisions, right? Because sometimes when you ask that type of question, you can kind of get a view on like, who are the different players involved? So like, oh, like Meta, what is the organizational structure of like this team I'm interviewing for? And how are, you know, the different players involved in making decisions? And usually at that point, you'll get an answer on like, who are the different stakeholders? Is it a flat or a hierarchical structure? You'll get a little bit of idea of how much autonomy you have. Then second question, to take it even a step further, right, is how much autonomy would I have in this role? How much autonomy do product managers have? Like straight up, just ask that. A lot of times you'll get really awesome candid answers. Like that's worked really well for me. So I use those type of questions to assess out what type of role it'll be, because I don't want to be in a position ever again where, you know, I don't want to be in a place that shoots down my ideas. Like it is totally fine if at the end of the day, you know, through stakeholder alignment and cross-org discussions, we decide to go a different direction, but it needs to be a discussion, right? Not just a, we don't like that, so we're shooting it down. So those type of questions really help.
What do you think was the difference between this role versus the previous two roles? Because your career satisfaction was a bit low in your first two roles, but your life satisfaction was super high for CoinDesk. But CoinDesk, your life satisfaction level plummeted with CoinDesk. Was it work-related or outside-related? Yeah.
So work-related. So I would say what happened to that company was, because it was like a really, really small company, I was the only product manager for a really long time. And it was me and the CPO. And that was it. And we had a deadline, right, to get this redesign out. And it was insane, like with the, what I was just saying about the team, right? That wasn't, the editorial team wasn't the only team we had to answer to. There was an advertising team, there was monetization team, there was, you know, the team that was managing the backend software. So essentially, right, like because I was the only product manager at the company, I was putting in a lot of work, a lot of hours. It was like that kind of startup life where you have to hustle for a while. We didn't have product design. We got it later. So I was doing that. We did not have UXR. So I was doing that. I was, you know, doing user interview on userinterview.com. I was reading all the scripts. Like essentially I was doing like way more work than what a product manager would be required to do. So how do you fit that in an 8-hour day? The answer is that you do not. Right. So I was working insanely long hours, and it was during COVID. I got this job during COVID. So now I'm at home. It's COVID. It's 2020, 2021. And I don't have a reason to leave, right? My house or my apartment. So I'm just sitting at my desk, working. I was putting in, you know, 14-hour days. And so of course your life satisfaction is going to plummet as a result of that.
During our pre-call, one of the things that stuck out with me was, this was also when you really bought into the idea of where your loyalty lies in terms of like, do what's best for you versus the company.
Yeah.
What was that pivotal moment when it was like, I got to do what's best for Trish?
That's such a good question. Like, so there was a point where like in, when I was working there, where Unfortunately, I had a concussion. I'm totally fine. But it was just like a stupid, silly thing where like I hit my head in the shower and all of a sudden I had a concussion. It was crazy. But anyway, I went to the doctor. I'm all good. It's all good. I'm not going to win. But that happened. And I thought my employer was going to be, you know, like, what's the right word? Like, okay with the fact that I would need to work reduced hours, right? Or would be kind of understanding, right? Is what I'm trying to say. They would be understanding and they would, you know, put me on like a reduced work schedule because I had a note from a doctor. Screens would really bother me for a little bit, stuff like that. That is not what happened. So basically they were like expecting me to work. If I wasn't, you know, able to put my camera on during calls, I was getting in trouble. And it got to the point where I was just like, I am literally not well. Like the fact that you are expecting me to do this, like I'm freaking done. And that was like, like you asked, what was the pivotal moment? Like that was the pivotal moment where I realized I need to prioritize myself and my well-being over work. And once I figured that out, that stuck with me forever until now. I'll never let work compromise how, you know, my daily life is going, my self-care, how I feel about myself. I always make time, you know, for the gym. I always make time to whatever, cook my healthy food, whatever it might be, right? Go doctor's appointments, right? Shit like that. So that was the pivotal moment where I kind of decided that.
How do you set your boundaries with work? It's like, I mean, I'm seeing this because it should be natural and it should be what's expected, but so many people have trouble with this.
Yes. And like, I will say one of the struggles that I have, and I'm not sure like if you feel like this as well, but for me, like, because we work at a company that is so international, it gets a little bit difficult with like time zones sometimes. Yeah. We're like in New York and it's, you know, it's 5 p.m. in my time, but it's 2 p.m. in California. And so I'm getting all these messages and I feel obligated to respond. So the way that I kind of set those boundaries, right, is that one thing that I really love that our work has, and I think other companies should do, is you are allowed to set your working hours in your calendar. So I set my working hours as 10 to 6. And that way, like once it's past six, like if someone tries to work chat me or, you know, whatever, respond to a message I sent earlier, put a meeting with me, my calendar and like my work chat is set up to tell them like, hey, this person is outside their working hours. And that really helps already, because that for me is like, people will probably think twice about messaging me when it's like 8 p.m. at my time, right? So that's one. Two is like, there's kind of like an understanding that I have with both my engineering team, my product team, my manager, where like, if it's not urgent, I should not be bothered outside of working hours, right? So it's like, you can send the messages if that's fine. I'm not saying don't message me, but I should not be expected to respond if it's urgent. And if it's like something that's really urgent, like everything is on fire, then like, you know, you have my work phone number. Some people have my personal number. Feel free to give me a call. But what I can tell you is that ever since I've started working at this company, which was over a year ago, that has not happened once. So those are the boundaries. I think it's really important that you decide what your working hours are. And once you're outside of that, you don't check work, right? So I used to have this really bad habit that I would have Slack on my regular phone, right? Not my work phone. Yeah. And so I just open it. At 10 p.m., I'd be out to dinner with friends. I'd open my Slack, right? I'm like, I am not doing this anymore. So I don't have any work stuff on my personal phone, only on my work phone. And I only bring my work phone out with me or to places when I feel like there's something important going on that I need to have a handle on, right? Outside of that though, I'm like, I leave work at my desk, and it's hard when you're working from home, right? Because you're home, but I leave work at my desk. I shut down the things at 6 p.m. and I will not be online until the next morning unless something urgent happens. And I stick to that.
Oh man, you're one of those two phone carriers.
Yeah. Oh yeah. The two phone. It's rough.
Ding, ding. All right.
It's better than having work stuff on your personal phone. Trust me, because then you can choose to not put your work phone on. Like I keep that thing powered off. It's on my desk. I don't freaking use it unless I have to, unless I'm going on a work trip or I'm going on a trip where I don't want to carry my laptop. Right. So stuff like that, but you really should not have work stuff on your personal phone. I'm a huge proponent of that. I think it's a bad idea.
This is hitting home really hard because I feel I have one phone. I've combined it. And sometimes out of habit, out of that adrenaline junkie, I just find myself checking it even though I don't have to.
Exactly. That is the slippery slope. That is a problem. Yeah. Once you get into that habit, you cannot break that habit unless you remove that stuff from your phone. Trust me, I've tried.
Very, very fair. So you came to this realization and you make the next jump into Grubhub. Winnie being Winnie, where we're basically this platform and community of women in tech, empowering ourselves with financial literacy and wealth and all of that. I have to ask, your net worth jumps with this.
Yes.
What's happening here?
So that's a great question. So I feel like when I was working at CoinDesk, I was definitely underpaid. It was a small startup. They didn't even have 401k set up. They didn't really have the opportunity to pay tech money. But when I got to Grubhub, like obviously they're not, you know, they're not Google, they're not Meta, but they are a big tech company. And so the, you know, amount that I was given in terms of like a base salary bonus, as well as shares, right? That made the amount of money that I was making in a year significantly skyrocket, right? So I wouldn't say double, but it was close to double. So that was like kind of a big deal for me. It like really changed the game for me. And I felt like I was finally kind of getting that salary that I, you know, deserved in terms of how I was working. So that's kind of what happened there. And the other thing is like, when one thing that I learned, and this is kind of a tip for anybody watching, right, is one of the things I realized was that when they ask you when you're joining, if they want like proof of, or they ask you what you're currently making, do not answer them, because that is how you get you down level yourself, right? Mm-hmm. If I had gone and they were like, oh, what salary are you making? And I told them, they would have maybe only given me 10 or 20K more than that. Instead, I got 80K more than that. So that is the difference, right? That is the difference. And you can't do that, because you're going to down level yourself. And that's like the biggest tip that I will give anybody listening. Do not tell them how much money you're making. If they ask for proof, it's actually illegal. If they want to see like a signed offer, like letter to show like that you had the employment, that is fine. You can redact your salary information. Do not give that out.
Wow.
That's like my biggest hot tip, but it's worked for me, right?
How did you assess I am worth this much?
Great question. That is research. That is talking to people, right? So I was lucky when I was running Grubhub, I had friends who worked there. So I asked them, I'm like, listen, be straight up with me. What are you making? So I know what to ask for. There are some amazing resources out there like Glassdoor, Levels.fyi, Blind, where people post their salaries and the roles that they have, as well as where they live. So you can see how you measure up and kind of pinpoint what the average is, what makes sense. You can also ask the recruiter for a average salary range of the role that you're applying to, and they can tell you. Sometimes they can lowball that though. So I would do the more like Glassdoor, Levels, talking to people, research first. And then you could ask them. And through all of those kind of details, you can make an assessment on what you think you deserve for the role. And they ask you, what are you looking for? So you want to do all that research before you answer that question.
Yeah. I'm also really appreciating on LinkedIn in job posts these days, they have the salary range.
That is huge. I am so glad that they do that now, because why would you waste your time applying to a role that you feel like is not worth your, you know, not what you're looking for in terms of money?
For sure. And what's happening here where your life satisfaction also takes another jump? Is this money therapy? What's happening here?
That's part of it. So I think part of it was feeling like I, you know, what comes with having more money, right? Better savings, better investments, better travel, being able to buy the clothes and the things that you actually want, to feel your best self. So that is definitely a huge part of it. And then also that happened to be like in my life, other things were going on. Like I moved in with my now fiance, things like that. So I was just like in a good place with my life, and like that kind of helped. And then lastly, working a normal freaking workday, right? So working now, not working 14-hour days, 12-hour days, working 8-hour days, and being able to actually do that happily. So those things kind of contributed to my life satisfaction going up.
I really appreciate this, because sometimes, especially in, you know, the tech culture, there's that hustle culture where it sometimes feels you got to pay your dues. But I love how you are proactively prioritizing yourself and setting your boundaries and keeping that as sort of top of your checklist on what you're looking for.
I do. And I tell every manager when I first join a company, I'm like, listen, I feel that I am a very efficient person in terms of my work. So I time box, like I'm very much like, I need to get this doc written by Friday. Like if I just time box like 3 hours on my calendar one day, I'll get it done. Right. So the way that I'm like, I think about it is like, if I'm super efficient and I can get everything done in an 8-hour workday, then why do I need to hustle and put in 12 hours? If you feel my performance is slipping, manager or whoever is responsible for that, then we can talk about it. But if there's no issues with that, then I should not be expected to work overtime, right? And that's always boded quite well for me. They're like, no, you're performing well. That's fine. Sometimes, like if you're having coastal stuff, like do I have to take the occasional meeting at like 7 o'clock my time? Yeah. Like, is that annoying? Yeah. But like, will I do it because I'm a team player? Absolutely. Right. But that is not every day. That is not every day. You cannot let that be every day. That's like once every few weeks, we have a scheduling problem and somebody will put on a meeting for 6:30, 7, 7:30. And they'll be like, Trish, I'm so sorry that it's at this time. But, you know, if you could try to make it. But it is a rare occurrence, right? People try to work within your time zone. So
it sounds like things were going pretty well at Grubhub. What was the impetus for switching over to Meta?
Yeah, things were definitely going well at Grubhub. I enjoyed the work I was doing. I was lucky to be working on like search and personalization, which was such a freaking cool area. Thinking about the algorithms that, you know, you would have for people to be searching for restaurants. How do you know what they like? What kind of AI are you using? You know, stuff like that. So that was really cool. But the reason that I ultimately decided to leave was twofold. So one, you know, aspiring product manager, well, not aspiring at this point. I was kind of a seasoned product manager. I was senior, but I think a lot of PMs, like one of their quote unquote dreams is to go work at one of these big companies, right? So Meta or Google or Apple or, I mean, what are they? Microsoft, you know, Netflix, not so much really anymore, I would say.
Oh.
But used to be an example of it. So that was always like kind of a dream of mine. And honestly, like when I was in college and there were like job fairs and stuff, right? They would always have Snap would be there, Meta would be there, you know, Google. And they would have these long lines of all these people wanting to be end or PM there. And I would even, you know, get in the line and talk to the recruiter. But unfortunately, like, because I was coming from Cornell with the engineering coursework was really hard. My GPA wasn't good enough to get those jobs out of school. So I was like, maybe sometime later in my career. And so when the opportunity came and a recruiter was in my inbox, right on LinkedIn, I was like, I'm not going to pass up. Like, this is something that I've always wanted to do. So that's one. And then I think two was kind of like the thing at Grubhub that one thing that I didn't like love was that a lot of the road mapping was kind of like, it was like more top down, like what, you know, they wanted us to do at, you know, the top level. And then they would have product managers kind of, you know, make micro decisions, but I wanted to be empowered to make larger decisions. So those were the two main things, but all in all, like if that recruiter hadn't been in my inbox at Meta, like who knows, like maybe would have still been at Grubhub today.
Interesting.
But I'm very glad that that recruiter reached out.
For sure. Things happen at a certain time for a reason.
Exactly.
What would you say is the difference with working at some of these like smaller companies versus at a bigger company? Is there really a work culture difference, like work process difference? Obviously, like it's going to be different company by company, but mm-hmm. Is there something really different about the manga companies?
I would think so. Like, I just think, I feel like there's two like major differences that I feel like with manga and stuff, like where I felt like, oh, I feel really empowered. So I think one thing is just like, I think things move like quickly, like a lot faster. Like people are kind of expected to get up to speed fast, which might be a little bit of a challenge. But once you're up to speed, like I really like kind of the culture of like, let's just like, you know, no, like at Grubhub, it would take like 3 weeks to make a decision. Here, it's like, let's get a review on the calendar and let's get a decision in a few days, right? So I love that. I think that's one key difference I've noticed is that because the company is so big, you have to kind of iron out these kinks ahead of time. You have to figure out what the best processes are. And a lot of that stuff is really streamlined, right? So that's one major difference I observe. And two, satisfaction of the people around you. Everyone I work with seems so happy to be at Meta, at their mm-hmm. job. And I don't think I've ever had a job where like there wasn't at least a few people that seemed like absolutely miserable. I'm not going to lie. So that is just such a big difference for me and something that I love coming to work every day because everyone I talk to, everyone that's working on these problems with me, anybody I have to collaborate with, they're passionate. They care about it and they're happy. And like that, I don't know about like anyone listening, but for me, like when the people around you feel empowered and happy, it rubs off on you. So for me, that's been the biggest differences.
Yeah, Miss Bubbly, fun, charismatic.
Hopefully I rub off on people.
Yeah. No, but I totally agree in a sense that, you know, they call it the golden handcuffs and salary is definitely one part of it, but the caliber that's of people part, and yeah. the teammate
exactly.
that you work with.
That matters more.
To leave that. Yeah.
I couldn't agree. Yeah, exactly. And the caliber of the people, right? Everybody who works here is absolutely brilliant. And I notice that every day and I'm humbled every day, like listening to people talk about stuff. And like, yeah, they say like it's, oh, people just go to those big companies for salary. I'm not going to lie. That's obviously a great benefit, right? But it's more than that, like you said.
So how does a day in the life, not necessarily a day, but maybe a week, a month, sort of how do you spend your time and energy in terms of percentage? All right, so about 25% in meetings.
Yes.
Product managers are definitely known for herding cats. I think another.
Honestly, we can call this like meeting / stakeholder alignment because that's what it is. Herding cats is such a good way of saying it. And then I would say like strategy. So that includes like writing docs, reviews, competitive analysis, deep thinking work, stuff like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then I would say 25. This is like a little bit bigger, the strategy piece. Yeah, I think 35. Kind of just like misc like to-do tasks almost. Like, you know what I mean? Like kind of like I have this list of just like kind of random things that I have to do, like scheduling this thing or you know what I mean? Like
I think this is totally fine. So about 15% goes into that.
Like misc stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like follow-ups. Feedback on other people's docs. Oh, and I lead a DEI circle. So like that kind of thing. And I manage the VRAS review process. So like VRAS review, all that kind of miscellaneous tasks.
Amazing. One thing I'm curious is if this was the ideal world, where would you spend the most of your time? What do you enjoy the most?
That's a really good question. In an ideal world, I would like to spend most of my time on the strategy piece, which I do. So that's great. On the working with like eng execution piece, I would say those would be my two. I think I would like less time to be in meetings if I'm being perfectly honest. Like I'm a people person. I love meetings. I love talking to people, but sometimes I don't feel like meetings are the most productive way to get XYZ done. I think a lot of times we'll have meetings for alignment where people could just read the doc and tell me if they're aligned. Right. So that kind of stuff.
But sometimes like, you gotta like squeeze people into a room.
It's true. And sometimes you do have to do that because otherwise you'll never actually get them to review it. Right.
Yeah.
That's the thing. But in an ideal world, you wouldn't have to do that. They would just review it and write their comments and sign off. And you wouldn't have to do that. And you would only schedule the meeting if someone had a really pressing argument or really differed on the way they were thinking or wanted to change something huge. Only then would you need to talk, right? If there's minor corrections, minor things that they want to edit to align, that can all be done asynchronously, in my opinion. And then I can spend more time doing the stuff like the strategy and the, you know, documents and the deep thinking and the prioritization. And that's like the stuff that I enjoy doing. It's not that I don't like stakeholder alignment. Like I do. It's more so that I just think too much time is spent in meetings.
I could totally see that. Competitor analysis is something I find always really interesting. Mm-hmm. How do you do it? Like what resources do you use other than Google?
A lot of Googling. Like I think that's interesting, right? Because I'm in the VR side. So for me, it's like, I'm always curious what's Apple doing. So I'll just go to their website and I'll see what they're doing. Or I'll be like, oh, what's Microsoft doing about their headset? And I'll go and what's the one TikTok did, Pico, right? So for me, it's like when you know what your competitive products are, you can kind of read up on them on their own resources, articles, websites. TechCrunch is a really good one. So that's good for competitor analysis. But when I was working at like, for example, Grubhub, right? The same thing. I would go on DoorDash and I would analyze, let's say I'm trying to create a search and discovery feature. I would search for something on DoorDash and I would document every step. I would search for something on Uber Eats. I would document every step. I would do it on Postmates. I would do it on ChowNow, right? All the different websites that there were. And so I think the biggest thing with competitive analysis is knowing who your competitors are, keeping track of what they're doing in like a chart and cross-referencing it with what you're doing, right? Because you don't want to be that one person that doesn't have a feature that all three of your competitors have, because then why would people come to you?
I always find this really delicate because yes, you do want to check off what all the other kids are doing. You don't want to be the lone person in the playground. But at the same time, if resource is limited, how do you prioritize between that versus really
differentiating
into your differentiating factor?
It's such a good freaking question. So I think you would have to think about like, you couldn't actually get this data, but you would have to think about usage. So like, is this a table stakes thing that you really need and people use, or is it just something that they all have because they all have it, right? So like, for example, right, when I was at Grubhub, some of the other companies had like a little bit of like this thing called kind of like a little ribbon where they had, you know, different cuisines and you could toggle by the cuisine, right? And Grubhub didn't have that. So I was like, oh, is this something that people actually use? So I was like, how can I do like a scrappy analysis of this? Okay, I'm going to ask my friends that use DoorDash and that use, you know, Uber Eats and stuff. And I'm like, yo, how often do you actually filter by this stuff? And when all of them were like, oh, all the time, I was like, oh, we actually should prioritize this, right? So any way that you could crowdsource like that stuff, and it's really hard sometimes to do when you don't have the actual data, but if you could crowdsource it, if you could try to figure out a way to understand what's table stakes and is actually needed, but what's versus what's not, it's just there, right? Then you could, it will help with your prioritization.
For also, sure.
Like effort of things. It wasn't that hard to build that out, right? If it was something that was going to take 6 months, maybe I would have been like, oh, we can do that later.
I absolutely plus one to everything that you're saying in terms of, especially if it's competitors and you have limited insight into data, what's a hacky way for you to get 80% there and just...
I'm a big fan of like, ask your friends. Like when I worked at CoinDesk, when I worked at Grubhub, I did that. Even when I worked at Grubhub, we did this thing where like a friend and I, the office was right by Bryant Park. We went to Bryant Park and we gave out like little gift cards to people that would just like come do a survey with us. If you have to be scrappy with it, you have to be scrappy with it. But there are such good ways to get user input, especially when you work at some place like Meta or Grubhub or, you know, apps that people use. But when I was working at CoinDesk, I would ask my friends to go on the website, but then the thing was like they weren't familiar with crypto, so they weren't like, that wasn't going to work for that. So then I set up a usertesting.com account and asked it to give me a sample of people that actually claim they're interested in crypto, and that did the job for me, right? So it really depends, but you always want to try to get as much user feedback as possible. That's like my biggest thing.
Love it. And while we are going into in reviewing your sort of career story, one thing that stands out is very much like your life satisfaction graph, you kind of jumped in spurts. Like it wasn't always, oh, I'm building off of this and this is a natural next progression.
Right.
And in our pre-call, one of the tools that you said you really leveraged was LinkedIn.
Yes.
How did you use LinkedIn to really halt your career trajectory?
Yeah, no, that's such a good question. Like, honestly, every job that I've ever got after my first job was via LinkedIn, right? So like, I think LinkedIn is such an amazing tool. If you use it correctly, you really need to like kind of spice up your profiles. But I think what's like really important to do to like differentiate yourself is like, add a summary to your profile about what you do, you know, include kind of keywords in when you're writing about like the different jobs you had. So for example, like my title is product manager, and like, so I'll come up in a product manager search, right? But not only that, then you can put skills on your profile. So I put like, okay, like data analysis, because I was proficient in SQL at one time, right? So SQL, now I'm not, so I don't have that on my profile anymore because it's been a minute, but you know, SQL, and that like
helped me. I love the honesty.
Yeah, it's been years, and like that doesn't just stay sharp, okay? You have to flex that skill. So like SQL, or for example, or, you know, prioritization, you know, stakeholder alignment, like putting those type of skills on your profile, as well as writing them in the bullets of like each job that you have, helps you show up when recruiters are searching for specific skills that they need for a role. Maybe they'll reach out to you, right? So that's one. Good to put your education on there. I don't think you need to put what year that you graduated. I don't think that's necessary, but just if you have an engineering degree or you have a tech degree, that'll help you stand out as well. So like, definitely make sure you have that on there. And then this one's interesting, but sometimes like putting in stuff in like the kind of activities and hobby section. So here's a good example, right? I put my sorority I was in college, right, in my profile, like it was like activities at Cornell, and I put my sorority, and then someone reached out to me for like a company, and they were like, oh, I also like noted on your profile, like, oh, I was in the same sorority at a different school, like, and we were able to connect over that. And that was a good way for me to get in. So it's always these random things, right, that you wouldn't even think about, but just putting as much detail as possible like on your profile is like going to be huge for you. And also, like, the other thing is, like, I think sometimes people, like, it's easy for profiles to get, like, lost. So you want to add stuff that'll help you kind of, like, stand out, right? So, like, always have a really nice photo, like, a good headshot, you know, an up-to-date headshot. Like, don't have some random cropping of a picture of you at a party, like, not a move. Like, you know, have a really nice headshot so that recruiters will be like, oh, this person looks good. Have the summary, you know, that'll help you highlight. Have a lot of connections, add a lot of connections if you can, you know. And also the last thing, like, I'll say is, like, I think every job that I've had, the recruiter has actually like reached out to me, which is really nice, but it doesn't always have to be like that. Like, you can also apply, and if your profile stands out, then they'll reach out to you, right? So it doesn't have to just be like, oh, I want recruiters to reach out to me. But those are all the things that have like kind of helped me on LinkedIn. Like, just kind of pimping out your profile is a good way of saying it, and just getting to as much information as possible. Adding a lot of connections, people you work with. There's also a section on LinkedIn now where people can like literally write recommendations for you. I would highly recommend that as well if you're looking for a job.
That's amazing. I think I need to take a consultation with you on how to improve my LinkedIn profile.
Let's do it.
That would be amazing. Would you say content generation is also something that's important?
Content generation?
As in like you writing your... Yeah, exactly.
I don't think so, because I don't do it, and it's not ever been. I mean, I do it sometimes. Like, if I'm speaking on a panel, oftentimes I'll do panels, things like that. I'll share the panel and I'll say, you know, come see me. But I maybe post once, to put it into perspective, every 3 months. So I wouldn't say you need to be like a LinkedIn influencer to get noticed. I just think you need to have a good profile, a good amount of connections, so that, you know, sometimes I don't know how the algorithm works exactly, but I would assume that like if a recruiter is searching for me and people that they are connected with have connected with me, maybe I'll show up for them. Right. So like, that's just kind of like different ways. And my sister, actually my twin, who we said would come up anyway in conversation, she's a recruiter. So she's actually a recruiting manager at a company. So she's given me lots of tips about how to like make myself stand out and stuff like that. And so that's also the type of things that I'm sharing about kind of pimping out your profile, adding those skills, like stuff like that. But I don't think you need to be like a poster, but I do need to think you need to keep it up to date. So for example, when I started at Meta, and, you know, I got a bunch of, you know, what's called like likes, comments, feedback mm-hmm. on the post, right? So just making sure that you're keeping it up to date, not necessarily being an influencer on LinkedIn.
Love it. Well, in the few minutes that we have left, I'd love to get your thoughts on maybe one or some things that I could change.
Oh, love this. Okay. So first thing that stands out to me, picture is great. 10 out of 10. So definitely hey. Don't change that. That's a great headshot. That's the type of photo you want. You look great. You look, you know, professional. I love it. Product manager, assistant AI at Meta. Okay. So I like your one-liner. That's great. You have your Meta, you have your college. It's all perfect. Do you have a summary?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So perfect. I was about to be like, if you don't have a summary. Okay. So perfect. Okay, great. And then scroll down to your experience. Okay. Okay. Yep. You have good. You have your founder on there. Okay. So one thing that kind of jumps out to me that I think you could do is in the sections where you have the kind of information about what your job was, you don't want to have like a bunch of sentences, because like no one's going to read that. So maybe just a few bullets, right? So for example, this one, product manager, new products, like validate early stage, gather quantitative qualitative feedback. Like, you could just do like bullet, like, oh, validate early stage beta products, like bullet, like gather, you know, feedback for product teams to inform iteration, bullet. And that way, like, it doesn't look so kind of like daunting. And then I would say another thing is scroll down. Okay, good, good. Skills, you have endorsements, recommendations. Very good. Perfect. So this looks really good. I think the only changes I would really make is like kind of doing a little bit like more of kind of a bulleted form of like your summary of your past like roles. And also I think you had recommendations also, so I wouldn't even need to add those. But yeah, yours is looking pretty solid.
Awesome. I haven't had that much outreach, but if once I make those changes and more inbounds come in, I will definitely let you know.
Good, perfect. Let me know. I think another thing that you could like do is like, if there are roles that you're like interested in and you want those like reach outs, sometimes it's good to like look at kind of the graph matters. So like look at the graph of like the recruiter and who they're connected to and see if you have any like connections, even if it's like third, second connection, fourth connection in common. And I think that helps you like show up quicker. So I think one of the things that's boded well for me is like I have 500 plus connections on LinkedIn. I have a lot of connections. And so I think I show up because a lot of times when people are searching like recruiters, like it'll be like, oh, you have like some connection in common with this person. So that's another big thing that'll help you stand out. So those would be the two things, like the bulleted thing and then just having more connections.
Interesting. I just want to touch on this briefly, the connections. So I was also hearing that, and I kind of stand by this as well, you should only accept connections of people that you would be willing to vouch for.
Yeah, I don't accept like random people. Yes.
Okay.
But the more people you know in your network at work, like you should add them. So like if I know somebody, like I'll add them on LinkedIn. And I'll even go out of my way where like if I'm working with new people at Meta, I'll make sure to add them to my LinkedIn. Mm. So always keeping it fresh, right?
Love it. Love it. Awesome. Trish, this was such a good combo. Thanks so much for coming on board.
Of course. I'm so glad that we got to do this. And you know, if there's any follow-up questions or anything I can do to help, like just let me know.
Love it. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great rest of your day and weekend, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays.